Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby Podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
As far as I can see, I always want to get in the Irish team. And that should be every young player's dream and ambition in this country. And if you're playing in a place where you're not going to get the opportunities in the big games, that they're the ones that get you picked. They are the ones, the Champions Cup games are the ones that get you picked. You need to be playing in a team and starting in a team for those games. It's as simple as that if you want to play in the Irish team.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Laya Healthcare, looking after you always. Proud sponsors of Real Health with Carl Henry.
Hello, welcome to Real Health with me, Carl Henry, in association with Laya Healthcare. Folks, on this week's show, I am delighted to be joined by hotelier John Brennan. In his brand new book, My Name is John, John writes about his battle with dyslexia, life as an entrepreneur, and how a cancer diagnosis wasn't going to stop him making a new business opportunity a massive success. John, a very big welcome to the show. How's it going?
Hi, Carl. Good to see you. Very good. Thank you indeed.
Long time no see. It's lovely to hear your voice and to see you. I haven't seen you for a long time. How's life?
You need to get out of the city and circulate around the country a bit.
I need to come visit you then in Kenmare. That's absolutely for sure. So how are things?
You won't meet me on the jogging trail anyway, so you rest assured.
So since the last time we would have spoken, lots of things have changed for you, obviously. I want to start with the TV, first of all. I would have known you from in the hotel. You looked after us very, very well there several times. And how did you find the transition of being on telly and becoming a national celebrity?
Yeah. Well, you know all the buttons to start with, all right. you see, it's very, very strange. And you don't know it. And you come from the same background in that you weren't a public figure and you weren't recognized and you weren't known. And then all of a sudden, people are saying hello to you. And I'm looking at them thinking, do I know you? Or how do you know me? And then it just rockets on from there. But that's the downside to it. And it's very difficult to live with that side of it at times. But the upside to it is, if you weren't recognized, what you were doing on television wasn't working. So it's a double-edged sword. And I have to say, you come out on the right side of it 9 times out of 10. But it isn't in truth. The biggest obstacle in it is that it's a loss of privacy, which you don't fully appreciate until you experience what that is. And that can be hard to live with. Not necessarily for me, but for family and that around that at times.
And were you surprised by that? That's once you went on telly, all of a sudden that just went, and it goes very good. I know myself, it goes very, very quickly.
Goes quickly, but we haven't. Well, the program is coming back on air next year, but we haven't been on live for 2 years now. So you kind of go out of people's memories too, as well, which is kind of nice. But the biggest shock you got was when you went to McDonald's and you were ordering a Big Mac and a large fries and a milkshake or something, and then they say, oh, I didn't think you'd eat that. And people said, and I'm thinking, how did they, you lose that privacy as a result. So then all of a sudden you're looking for the corner seat to face the wall.
Yeah. I get that every now and again. Like up and down to Cork a huge amount. And on the odd time you'd be absolutely exhausted and haven't had a really tough weekend or whatever. And you give in to temptation and you'd swing by the drive-in and Cashel on the way home. And like that, they're like, you're that fella off the telly.
Well, do you want to know the bad news now? That's exit 8, right? And I would always call into exit 8, get the takeaway, and then drive back on the motorway because I wouldn't eat in the restaurant. And then you pull in the lay-by 1.5 miles further down the road when you join back onto the motorway. And the bad news is that lay-by is now closed. And I passed it three nights ago at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm coming down and it's closed, and I'm thinking, oh God, where am I going to have me dinner?
And do you find that the pressure of that stress causes you stress or causes you anxiety is probably a little bit strong, but you know what I mean? Are you stressed out by the fact that people know who you are?
No, I wouldn't be stressed at all. It wouldn't stress me at all. You'd be conscious of it at all times, but I wouldn't call it stress, no, by any means, no.
Okay. Now, the book, tell me more about the book and about the title of the book specifically.
Did you know
more? Of course, it jumps off the page really well. And tell our listeners about that a little bit more.
Okay, so the name of the book is My Name is John, J-H-O-N. I have to think about it. And the reason for that is that when I was growing up, I was very bad with dyslexia. And I had to overcome that in my teens and still live with it today. I don't think you ever cure it fully. But it's living with that. And the whole reason why I wrote the book, and the only reason I wrote the book, was that there's a whole lot of kids out there today. And when I say kids, I'm talking about mid-teens, late teens, coming to Leaving Cert who are not academically driven. And the society in the Western world has an obsession with third level college. And it is a rite of passage for a Leaving Cert student to go into third level college. And society views them slightly differently if they don't go to third level college. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. And I think it has caused huge anxiety for teenagers and Leaving Certs to know what to do. Then they go to college, and I've employed loads of them, and they go to college and they don't like the course, they drop out, and then their whole self-belief becomes diminished, and that has all sorts of further issues on it. While that may not be and isn't the proper route for an awful lot of children or kids, teenagers, and I just think it's important that that needs to be aired, because I think generally speaking the pendulum has gone too far in towards the academic qualifications and the skills qualifications and the basic skills of knowing how to sell and knowing how to talk to people. One of the best upbringings you could have would be selling flowers in Moore Street. Because if you can do that in Moore Street, my God, you can do anything anywhere you want to go. And it's a bit of self-belief. And I think that was the only reason I wrote the book. Everything else that's in it and everything else built around it is fluff. The main point of the book is to give people hope who would not be achieving the best in school.
Tell us about what dyslexia actually is. So for those who are listening and who don't know.
It's a stupid name for a condition that has a problem with letters and words. Like, could you believe it? There's a Y and an S in the first three letters. I wouldn't say there's another word in the English language has that combination of letters. So it's a difficulty with letters and with words, which leads to reading and maths and sums. And you see things differently. Like if I'm here now in a bedroom in the Lansdowne Hotel 201, okay, I could look at that sign and see 102. And you just read things differently. And back in when I was in school in the 70s, before you were born, I was there and the condition wasn't understood in school. So as a result, you'd be deemed to be stupid and you're put sitting at the back of the class. And that's the way we drifted for a lot of years. And then I had a wonderful school teacher, Finbar O'Driscoll, and he spotted something and then told me, my mother, that I should be brought to be assessed for dyslexia, which we didn't even hear of at the time. We didn't know of it. And off I went. And that's what I was diagnosed with, which I was thrilled because that's a beautiful name. It's a beautiful word. It's like it's exotic and it's different. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, I have that. That's really great. Yeah. So it was nice to be labeled with something that other than stupidity. And once that happened, then I suppose you relax a little bit and say, yeah, but there's ways of working with this. And then you go and I did summer schools in Bray for 3 years in a row. And I did classes then every weekend. And then all of a sudden you learn how to look at words differently and you learn how to read. But it's funny because when you look at many, many hugely successful people around the world, different league to me totally now, a lot of them suffer from dyslexia. Because your actual brain has to work twice as fast and you're looking at angles and you're looking at things to see how to figure them out, much more so than a person who you'd ask a question and I'll answer it. But I'm thinking here now, looking at you with your hand on your chin, what's he thinking of asking me next? And that's why you're always thinking like that. And that's very, very good. But you need to be strong-willed and strong-minded and you need to get over the hill of not being in the top 10% in the class. And being in the lower 10% of the class, but still have an ability and having skills that could be adapted and used in a different way that would really benefit you in the long run.
And have you always been strong-willed and strong-minded and motivated?
It's very funny because I would never have thought I was until you write a book. And then you look back and you read it and you think, oh my God, did I do that? Like at 17 and a half years of age, just 18 years of age, I got a grant from the IDA, which was for a woodworking factory in Sligo. And I got £82,000, which is about €112,000 today in 1985. So that was a ferocious amount of money. Now, I'm writing the book and reading it, and I'm thinking to myself, how did I put that application together? Like, what application was so good in 1985 to attract that sort of money from the IDA, who would have been getting, in Sligo, where the application went in, they would have been getting applications from Abbott Laboratories, from Brosh, from a whole host of Stiefel, a whole host of international companies in the area. And then I'm a 17-and-a-half-year-old, 18-year-old, I put in this application, they say, yeah, that reads great. They interview me two or three times, they say, yeah, we'll support him, and they write a check. So when you look back on things like that, you would have to say, like, I bought my first house when I was 15 and I gutted it.
15.
Yeah, 15. I hadn't got two recs, right? It cost me €8,000, a lovely little house, two up, two down, down the back in Sligo. And I rented it to three girls who were coming to Kenmare or to Sligo from Roscommon, they were from. But anyway, built the house, but renovated the house. The girls came in, they stayed 3 years. We got great. They were to left us with the hospital in Sligo. And then they moved out. And then shortly after that, then I sold it. But I tripled my money on that. But like at 15, 16 years of age, to build, buy a, I was 16, I suppose, at the time, to be able to buy a house and do that. Yes, I suppose I was strong-willed, but I would never have thought I was until you read back and look at it.
So I suppose one of the tips to take from the interview for people is, regardless of anything, life skills are hugely important, and the ability to be able to buy, sell, learn, yeah, all of that. They're huge skills that you need to learn at a young age and to bring through the rest of your life with you.
One of the best skills you can learn is to know how to look at a person straight in the eye and shake their hands. If you can do that, then you're across a couple of hurdles. And I think that's where Irish people have been very good when they've gone overseas. They have bond and they build relationships with people very, very quickly, and honest relationships. And they have a bit of banter. There's a bit of fun. And they break down those barriers much faster than any other nationality, I think. And I think that's why when you look at corporations and Irish people overseas, they've done extremely well because of that skill. There is another element of that, which is called the GAA, but we'll go into that again in a few minutes. But those skills are hugely important. But I would never, ever, ever interview a person on the strength of their CV. That would not come into my radar whatsoever. Their personality and their hospitality skills in our business are far more valuable than a piece of paper with a degree or a PhD or a master's written on the top of it. And certainly there's avenues for all of those qualifications. But generally speaking, in our business and what we employ is a good personality, we can teach them the rest. So that's why I say when I get youngsters in working with us and they have to go to college, they have to go to college, they have to go to college, it's not suited for a lot of them. And then they hit a brick wall after a year. And then I think that after that, the consequences are huge because it knocks them off track for a couple of years and it breaks their self-confidence and all of that. Whereas if they were selling flowers on Moore Street, they'd be 10 times better off.
Folks, you're listening to Real Health with me, Carl Henry, Association with Leia Healthcare. John Brennan is giving us lessons of life, actually, is what I would call this the interview so far. Simple lessons of life, which would be really important. So you went from Dublin to Sligo. You moved over to Sligo. How did you get yourself from there down to Kenmare?
Wonderful story, this one. Dad got emphasis. We owned a shop and step aside in Dublin, which was out in the country at the time. He owned a shop, and then he got very ill like that overnight. He'd emphysema and chronic bronchitis hit him in an hour behind the counter in the shop one Saturday. He collapsed, and he lived then for 17 years after that, but he was on oxygen for 15 hours a day for the 17 years. So mum looked after him at home. There's 8 years between myself and the next sibling, Susan. So I was kind of an only child in that sense, and that they were all kind of grown up by the time I was five. And then dad, because he's bad chest, at that time in the 80s in Dublin, the smog was horrendous from all the chimneys and the smoke. So the air wasn't clean. So he said, fine, we get out of here because I need as much clean air as we can get. And my mum was from Sligo, and dad had a farm, had bought land in Sligo previously, and he said he'd build a house. So I was dragged along. I was only probably 13 at the time. So we went to Sligo, and then I went to school in Sligo out in Ballesteira, which was wonderful. And then I left there at halfway through the junior cert, or the inter cert, because I couldn't handle the rest of another exam in front of me. It drove me around the twist. So I said, forget this. So I left, and then I went to work in a vegetable truck, and then I went to work in the Sligo Park, and had 13 wonderful years in the Sligo Park. And then I was trying to buy a hotel in Sligo and open a hotel, and the whole thing fell apart at the last minute. And then Francis, my brother in Kenmare, said, why don't you come down to me here? He says, because I'd work for you down here. So we were just after building a beautiful house in Sligo, Gwen and myself. We were only married a year and a half. And we said, fine, we'll go to Kerry. And off we went to Kerry. and the rest is history. Yeah.
Wow. And how do you find working with a sibling? I'm intrigued by that there.
Yeah, probably easier than working with your father.
Good answer.
No.
I'm sure that's very true, by the way. I'm sure that's very true.
I'd say I'll be getting a phone call, really.
You might do.
No, working with Francis was a huge, huge learning curve, because I was coming from a quantity 3-star hotel to a quality 5-star hotel. And we did all things to all people in Sligo. We did weddings, dinner, dances, funerals, baptisms, divorces, separations. All of those things we looked after in the Park Hotel in Kenmare. We only look after resident guests, couples predominantly, who are away for a nice luxurious escape, and that's our business. So it was a very, very different environment to work in totally. And I suppose that brought some pressures from me, because Francis would have expected X and I was only delivering Y. So there was a learning curve in that, but we got up that curve fairly fast, thanks be to God. But it was a very different operation. Outside of work, it was never an issue. But it's funny now, because there's 13 years between Francis and myself. So when I was 10, he was 23. He was gone. So I never knew Francis till I came to Kenmare. Like, we never lived in the house together. We just didn't know. We met at Christmas if he wasn't working, and you'd meet as siblings meet. But the age gap between us would have put us in a totally different place.
And one of the lessons that I'm pulling from the chat so far is the fact that it's about knowing your market or knowing your job. Like, you even chatting to you there, you know your customer inside out. You've done all your homework on that. So for people listening in, that's important. Know what you do and know it really well.
Yeah. You're better off being one thing and one thing very good than multi things. And certainly in all the businesses we have, we focus on a particular element of it, and that's all we do. And I hate, people often say to us in the Park Hotel, oh, the staff are lovely. They're absolutely gorgeous, which thankfully, I'm looking out the window here in the Lansdowne Hotel at two of them across the road, looking at a menu, planning dinner out tonight. Our two receptions are across the road. But we don't distract our people away from a resident guest. Like, generally speaking, when you go into a hotel, the porter will be bringing bags up to a room. He has to go and get meeting room chairs. The waters have to be replenished at 11 o'clock when the meeting room breaks. The guy's head is so fried from doing so many things, he hasn't time to talk to anyone. And that's one of the wonderful things that Irish people have, is the ability to talk, as you can tell here and now. And that is a cornerstone of the Park Hotel, because we don't distract our people away from a resident guest. And that comes with a price. Because you don't have a turnover as big as you could have, because you're not doing everything that you possible to do. But the quality of the business that you're doing and the premium you get for it is very important. And that's why I very much harp on about that when we go on At Your Service and do the TV show. There's a huge tendency for a business to copy what's happening down the road, because the business down the road is doing a good business. All you're offering is the market two versions of the same thing. And you're only going to compete with them on price. And at the end of the day, price, like, the customer always pays. There's no other way around it. Okay, if the customer doesn't pay, the business doesn't succeed. So it's how you give the customer the best value possible for the experience they give. And that's not always based on price. And that's where the Park Hotel comes into its own.
One of the things in the book is around overcoming obstacles. And I think it's fair to say with yourself that sometimes you know you're a risk taker. So those obstacles, you don't see them, or you're not afraid of them, and you take the risk and go for something, such as the likes of Drumquina, the Lansdowne that you've done now.
Yeah.
You've been through a pandemic, you've been through an economic crash, probably one or two of them.
Yeah.
So for people listening in, it's to believe in yourself and sometimes take those risks.
No, they would be hugely calculated risks. And actually, if you look at Drumquina and you look at Lansdowne, the actual risk was not doing them. Because if we didn't do Drumquina at the time, we wouldn't have had financial independence from the bank, which we were up the walls with at the time in the Park Hotel. We had the opportunity of eliminating a possible competitor by buying the Drumquina. And because someone could have bought that, put a lot of money into it, and have a serious competition for the Park Hotel on its doorstep. So there was a whole load of reasons to do it. The real risk was not doing it. And the Lansdowne is the exact same. You walk down the drive of the Park Hotel, the Lansdowne Hotel, here since 1790, directly across the road from the hotel. if that wasn't run properly and a commitment to the standard that we would like, that diminishes our product across the road. It diminishes the town of Kenmare. When you drive in, it's the most prominent building. When you drive into town, it's straight there in front of you, big, big building. If that wasn't properly presented, the town doesn't look its best. So they were all calculated risks. If you offered me a hotel in town X tomorrow, I would think long and hard about it. But those two moves, the risk, the real risk in both of those businesses was not doing it.
And is it fair to say to people listening that, I suppose, you know, along with knowing what you do and knowing it well, and, you know, but also kind of in some respects future proofing? Because I remember when your spa first opened in the park, I think you were the first spa in the country to open before it became a thing, which it absolutely is now. So trying to look ahead and forecast down the line of what's coming, that's really important too. And then again, part of the calculated risk process for opening that. But you guys were the first to do it before anyone had even thought about spas.
It's funny now, because I brought a man in from America called Bernard Burt. And Bernard Burt, he has to be dead now at this stage, or 120, one or the other. But anyway, Bernard came over. He was living in Washington at the time, and he owned a little small travel agency in New York called Spa Finder. And he did very well. And he sold Spa Finder, the travel agents, to Pete and Susie Ellis, who own it today. They closed the shop, the travel agents, and they just stayed everything online. Spa Finder, I've met them many times. I know them very well. Lovely, lovely couple. But anyway, Bernard, anyway, I brought him over and I'm showing him through the spa, because he is the godfather of spa. This guy knew spa, Golden Door, the Nugget, all the big ones in the States, Calavi. He would have been the guy who they would have all gone to for inspiration and for the thought process and the whole thing. So we were in the middle of the build in Kenmare, and I said, would you like to come over and see? He said, I'd love, I've never been to Ireland. So over he came anyway, and I'm showing him around. He said, John, there's a huge mistake here. I said, what's that? He said, you have no swimming pool. I said, no, I said, we don't. He says, that's not going to work. Well, I said, hold on now, bear with me now for a minute. In America, I said, you're all members of country clubs, or you have your own swimming pool at home. Swimming in America is not a problem because you have access to pools. In Ireland, we don't have access to pools. And the difficulty with the word spa, which is a three-letter word, I drive a car. Me telling you I have a car, you don't know if I drive a Rolls-Royce or a Mini. It means nothing. And spa is the exact same. But the spa that we wanted wasn't a leisure centre with treatment rooms. We wanted a proper destination spa. So I decided not to build the pool because I wanted to establish in the marketplace the difference between spa and leisure centre. And I said to him, in 4 years' time, I will build a proper swimming pool, but not until we've established the spa world first. And that's what we did. And then he came back and I built a 25-metre pool, beautiful swimming pool, 2.5 lanes wide, 25 metres long, stainless steel, which is really unusual, but a really good finish. And we built that. And then we have our swimming pool as well. But it was important that we established spa before we built the pool. But that's... travel is the best education you can have. And our daughter has just qualified from college last May, and I told her to go away for 2 years. Don't want to see her, get on a plane, and off she went. She's in Malta at the moment. But you cannot beat travel for experience and for education, particularly for me. I would much prefer, Francis doesn't agree with this for financial reasons, I would much prefer to stay in a 5-star hotel where I'm going to learn something than a place that's €150 cheaper and I'll learn nothing. I think that €150 that I spend is the best value money we will get, because you'll pick up some little nugget. Like I was in a hotel the other night and they had a hairdryers in the wardrobe, as every hotel does, but they had a little tag on it, have a good hair day. And just little things like that you pick up when you travel and you stay someplace nice. But I think travel is hugely important.
People will get from the conversation already that you're an optimist. You're a hard worker, you're a bit of a risk taker, you're an optimist. How do all those three traits come to forbear when you get diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Okay.
How does that mashup happen?
I'll tell you exactly. It's good. It's funny now. Okay. I had pains in my stomach. We eliminated curries. We eliminated gin. We eliminated red wine. We eliminated white wine. I was still getting pains in my stomach. And this particular Saturday night, I was benching too. I didn't sleep at all. I was walking all over the kitchen. And the next day I rang my sister, Kate, in Dublin, who works in the medical world. And I said, listen, I said, I'm in trouble. I said, I need to speak, talk to someone. Oh, she says, I know the guy in Cork. She says, go to him. So I said, fine. So I went to him on Tuesday. He had a look at me. He said, John, he said, it's gallstones. He says, not a problem. He says, we'll do a laser on them. We'll take them out. And he said, burn them out. And he said, it'll be fine. He says, come in to me on Friday. Sounds, says I. So get in the car over to him on Friday. He did the job, everything happy out, not a bother. Left on Friday evening, came back to Kenmare, everything was fine, wasn't bothering me at all. And about a week later, he rang me. He said, John, he says, you won't believe it. He said, we're after detecting cancer in the gallbladder, which we removed. I said, grand. He said, I don't know anything about it. He said, not my forte. He said, Mary Cahill's your girl in Cork. He said, make an appointment with her. Sound. So I made the appointment, went over to Mary, and that was fine. She did tests, and then I had to go back 3 weeks later. And the 3 weeks later, we were filming in Birr in County Offaly. And I had to take the morning off from filming to go to get this diagnosis at 11 o'clock in Cork. So we went down to Cork. I went from Tipperary. Gwen left and went over from Kenmare. We met in Mary Cahill's rooms in Cork. And she told us it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which now is like tiddlywinks to me. I hadn't a clue what that meant. And it was stage four, which didn't. I'm looking at her thinking, now, is that 4 out of 5, 4 out of 10, or 4 out of 100? I hadn't the notion what stage four was at that stage. So poor Gwen would be much more medically minded than I, so she understood it and she started roaring and crying. And then Mary said, listen, she said, the good news is, she said, it's treatable, but she said, it's not curable. Well, I said, that's fine. If we can treat it, I said, that's grand. So I was happy enough. So we left there. I went back to Tipperary filming. Gwen went back to Kenmare, God love her, on her own in the car, which wasn't an easy trip for her, I'd say, at all. And that was at 11 o'clock in the morning. And at 5 o'clock that afternoon, I got a phone call from the auctioneer to say that we'd bought Drumquina. The bank had accepted our deal. So that's how you deal with a diagnosis like that. And you know something? It was the best thing that ever happened, because it focused my brain for the year I was having treatment. I was doing the Landstar, or the Drumquina Manor Up, which was basically an abandoned site for 12 years, derelict. We had, there was all pampas grass growing over the avenue, which wasn't tarmac, it was only a gravel avenue, and it was in a shocking state. So we had an awful lot of work to do there, but that kept the brain focused, because you can become very demoralized with a diagnosis like that. And I would be strongly of the opinion, we all have a terminal illness called life. So the question is, when does, what happens during it, and how long do you have? And no one knows that. So one of the good things about being diagnosed with cancer is you think about that a lot more, and you get a lot more out of your life every day as a result. So I would be hugely conscious of more time home and more time off than I would have been. I'd have worked 18 hours a day for 30 years. So I would only do 10 hours a day probably now. But you'd be just much more conscious of that now than I would have been if I wasn't diagnosed with cancer. So that's good.
That was my final question for you, which is, I can get the, and I haven't mentioned it several times over the years, I get it, how you love what you do. You have a just absolute grow for the job, the people, and I'm being very, very good at what you do too. How do you switch off, or how, or do you switch off?
You don't go to McDonald's anyway.
Not anymore.
How'd you say? Okay, we don't golf or anything, but I have a boat, and I go off on the boat if at all possible. And we just love that, because that means you can drop an anchor for 4 hours down Kenmare Bay. You can have a picnic, and it's just bliss. And that's the way we'd be in the normal run of the world. When travel was easy, we would have gone to Spain once a month. For 2 days, and that would switch off. We'd cycle. You'd be very happy with me there. I'd cycle 20 kilometers a day and walk 10 kilometers every day in Spain. No hills, all flat, but it was grand, fresh air. And we'd switch off when we go to Spain, all right, like that. Yeah, we would do that, and certainly on the boat.
We bought a camper van a few weeks ago. I'd like that's our version of your boat. We just go off on a Sunday for a spin and just park up somewhere and and just relax and unravel. And it's absolutely super. It's
subconsciously, you're off duty once you're behind the wheel of that motorhome.
Absolutely. And we only drive, we only drive it on a Saturday or a Sunday. Yeah. And the subconscious brain is all activated in full relaxed mode. The phone goes in the glove box. You don't see it. You're in a totally different space while you're there, and it's become our space of downtime and relaxation. You know,
I get worried about you when I hear you're sitting in the avenue of the hotel, sitting in the van
with the tent at the side of it. That wouldn't be part of the image of the hotel, John. That is for sure. John, it's been absolutely, yeah. I've thoroughly enjoyed catching up with you. It's been so long since we've chatted. You were very, very good to me many years ago. I remember just after Christmas one year, I went over to the park to train for a couple of days, and you put me up in the chauffeur's room. Yes. And I haven't forgotten the hospitality you guys showed me all those years ago. I was a bit of a lost soul, so it was much appreciated. John, remind us of the name of the book.
My name is John, published in all bookshops now, and it is really for parents and for children who find schooling a little bit challenging.
I think everyone who's listened to the interview today will be inspired, motivated, focused, and just feel good. It's one of those lovely chats with people when the podcast really kind of does its thing. So it's been great to catch up, and I'll see you in person hopefully very, very soon. Folks, that's it for another episode of Real Health with me, Carl Henry, in association with Leia Healthcare. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. As ever, you know where we are, at Carl Henry PT on Twitter and on Instagram, realhealthandindependent.ie. And finally, don't forget to rate and review. And we'll see you very, very soon for more Real Health. Slán go fóill.
Leia Healthcare, looking after you always. Proud sponsors of Real Health with Carl Henry.